You know, we're really lucky to have such a diversity of wildlife here in the state of Wisconsin. Really, with every subtle change in the weather and the season, I think we get to see some fascinating differences in their activities. And we're going to talk about that a little bit today. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guests today, David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Dave, thank you for coming by. Always great to see you.
Well, thank you for having us over here. We appreciate being back.
Jamie Knack, our other guest, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW. And Jamie, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here today.
Wisconsin is home to so many endangered species, and folks at the university and the DNR, I think, do a lot of great work to protect and support them. One of our birds that's in a bit of trouble is the Kirtland's warbler. And do you guys have any status report on them? I think they're only in Adams County, right?
Yeah, they're in Adams County, and they're starting to spread up into some of the northern counties. So they did.
Oh, good.
They've seen them up in Marinette County in past years, and they are doing a survey of other parts of the state outside of Adams County, looking to see if the Kirtland's warbler is expanding its range here in Wisconsin. And just to give a little background history, that the Kirtland's warbler is a native bird to our state of Wisconsin, and it had been extirpated years ago and had kind of recolonized the state of Wisconsin, came back into the state on its own, I think, in 2006. And one of the things about Kirtland's warblers, they're tightly tied to jack pine stands. And one of the reasons they are struggling for sustainability or their populations aren't as sustainable as we'd like is because the jack pine stands are kind of falling by the wayside in terms of habitat. And then these birds are also especially susceptible to nest parasitism. So brown-headed cowbirds will come and lay eggs in the Kirtland's warbler nest, and those brown-headed cowbirds typically will hatch out earlier than the Kirtland warbler nestlings or chicks. And they're larger, so as the Kirtland warbler parents bring food back to the nest, the brown-headed cowbirds outcompete the native or the Kirtland warbler chicks for the food and survive, and the Kirtland warbler chicks don't survive. So in 2006, they came back into Adams County, and this year so far they've had 7 pairs of Kirtland's warblers in Adams County, and they've made 8 nesting attempts, and 3 of those nests have been successful, 4 failed, and 1 is still active, and they've had so far 4 fledgling chicks. So chicks have made it out of the nest. And as part of the cowbird issue, the United States Department of Agriculture and Wildlife Services is doing cowbird trapping and has been doing cowbird trapping for the past number of summers to try to limit the number of cowbirds in the area so they can reduce or they'll never eliminate, unfortunately, but reduce the amount of nest parasitism by the cowbirds. So it's a great story, another one of those exciting success stories where these animals are starting to come back, and the DNR and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is doing all they can to help the bird.
And nice to see that being done. What about you or me? What can the public do to help support the Kirtland's and maybe the other Wisconsin endangered resources or species?
Well, I think certainly if you are in the range of Kirtland's warblers, Adams County and Marinette County and things like that, and you're a landowner and you have existing jack pine stands on your property, you want to manage those jack pine stands so that they are beneficial for the Kirtland's warbler. They're in good condition. If you can plant jack pine, that'd be great as well. Anything you can do to discourage brown-headed cowbirds, that's also beneficial. And if you are not anywhere near Adams County or Marinette County and you don't have jack pine in your property, you can always contribute money to the Endangered Resource Fund of the DNR, and that will also go to help birds like Kirtland's warblers.
Yeah, those are all great points. And if you listen and you're wondering, what do they look like? We have a nice photo up on my Facebook page. So just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You don't have to be a Facebook member to go there. You can get a good look at a nice Kirtland's warbler. That's right there that probably we got from you.
Yeah, they are beautiful birds, and I had never seen one in the wild until a number of years ago. I went up to Adams County and saw one, and I was amazed at how big they are. I mean, they're a pretty good-sized warbler, and warblers, if you're familiar with warblers, black and white warblers or yellow warbler, whatever, they're a relatively small bird, but this Kirtland's warbler is probably another, I don't know, quarter to a third larger than most warblers.
So the maybe 5 inches?
Yeah, think? Something like that.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's I have not seen one. So
yeah, they're just beautiful.
Well, Jamie, here's one for you. We got a Facebook question from Dennis. Says, today I saw robins on the ground. Oh, it was actually yesterday. Yesterday I saw robins on the ground and feathers puffed out, mouths open like they were panting. Also groups of barn and tree swallows on the ground in the gravel, which seemed unusual. This was along the Wausau Trail, Lake Butamore near Oshkosh. This behavior could be due to the high dew point and heat. Is that a good guess?
Yeah, that's a pretty good answer, especially given Monday and Tuesday's weather. Not so much today. Beautiful day out there today. But yeah. The high humidity, but the high heat as well. So birds don't have sweat glands, and they use the opening the beak and also fluffing feathers to allow for air movement and cooling off and panting, as he suggested. So, yeah, that was a technique to try to cool the body temperature down. And as far as the groups of swallows, they're going to tend to be more in groups and in nature and probably just resting and hanging out in that gravel away from the vegetation.
David Drake and Jamie Nack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology are guests today, and I haven't even given the phone number yet, so let me do that right now. If you have a question, boy, we have a lot of open lines right now because I haven't given the number. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Results of a recent waterfowl survey are now available. I think sounds like good news. First of all, was the DNR again and the Fish and Wildlife Service who did that report?
Yep, and also the Canadian Fish and Wildlife Service because the waterfowl are migratory birds, and any animal that spends part of its life in more than one state or more than one country is automatically a migratory species. And so there's a lot of coordination in terms of management of waterfowl populations between the Canadian Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and then each of the 50 states. And the United States is divided into flyways. So you've got the Atlantic Flyway, the Mississippi Flyway, Central Flyway, and things like that. And essentially, it's the north and south migratory path that these waterfowl take, north going obviously in the spring and going south in the fall. And so they do an annual survey in Wisconsin. They've done this survey for 42 years, 42 straight years. And essentially, over, a, I don't know, 8 or 9 day period, they fly transects. And so they do an aerial count of waterfowl along these transects. And the good news is that the United States Fish and Wildlife Survey showed the highest North American duck population estimate in the 59-year history of the survey. So
that's wonderful.
Ducks are good. The duck populations look like they're doing really, really well. And in past years, we've had some good news about certain duck species like mallards and wood ducks and things like that, that those populations are increasing or at least holding their own, if not increasing. And it is important to note that this is obviously, you know, is one point, one data point along a multi-year, multi-decade trend line. So next year, the population could go down a little bit, depending on environmental conditions, the amount of water in the landscape. You know, some of these broods during the springtime are pretty sensitive to cold weather and wet weather and don't fare so well sometimes. And so it seems like all the environmental conditions lined up this year, and the survey was found a lot of ducks.
Yeah,
so
that's wonderful. And if you like seeing ducks, I'll tell you, Ducks Unlimited was probably one of the great organizations out there that has purchased land property not only in the U.S., but in Mexico and Canada,
yeah,
I believe
that's right.
That's right.
To save the nesting areas.
Yeah, and that prairie pothole region in the Dakotas and western Minnesota is super valuable, and there's been a lot of education of the farmers to not fill in those potholes and keep them for the nesting ducks. And Ducks Unlimited, as well as a lot of these wildlife agencies, both state and federal, have been very critical to educating the farmers and just helping to improve the habitat.
I always think that one good thing you can do to help support ducks and other birds is to buy a federal duck stamp.
Yep, that's absolutely.
Right. That's a cheap, inexpensive.
Federal and state.
Federal and state. Yeah, I have them all every year.
Yep.
And they're beautiful pieces of art.
Beautiful. And all the money, I mean, the thing about that is, I mean, really, all the money goes directly to the benefit of the birds.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of Well, there isn't any waste on them, on those.
Right.
Tekla in Beaver Dam, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question is about pelicans that I'm seeing at Patrick's Marsh north of Sun Prairie. And they were there last summer and they're this summer. I didn't know Wisconsin had pelicans. But I guess there's Pelican Lake, Wisconsin. So if you could give me some history on, have they always been here? Is this something new? And they seem to leave that lake. They've had babies, because I've stopped a couple times and looked and took pictures, and they've had babies. But they don't stay there all summer.
Yeah, it's somewhat recent. I guess you could say that we've been seeing lots of pelicans.
Yep, pelicans are coming back, Tekla, and that's a good question. And so as an aside, if it was up to me, you would not be able to name a location or a neighborhood if that species didn't exist. So a lot of times you'll see like Quail Ridge. Well, if quail aren't there, you can't name that neighborhood Quail Ridge. So if there's Pelican Lake, there better be pelicans on that lake, dangummit. But yeah, pelicans, and it's the white pelican. We've got two species of pelican in North America, the brown pelican, or in the eastern half at least, the brown pelican and the white pelican. And it's the white pelican we have here, and they have been coming back and increasing in numbers in recent years, and especially if you go up on Lake Michigan around Green Bay, some of the islands up around Green Bay, and there's a lot of pelicans up there. And I'm guessing that the pelican population is increasing, and they're starting to kind of expand in their range here in Wisconsin. Again, it's a native species; they belong here. And I'm guessing at some point. So obviously pelicans are fish-eating birds, so they're migratory. They leave our area come fall, because when the lake's ice over, they can't feed, and so they go south. But pelicans are probably going to be a species like cormorants. And if you're familiar with cormorants up in Lake Michigan in particular, that there's a lot of conflict with cormorants and some of the fish populations up there, because they're such efficient fish predators. And pelicans are the same way, and I think pelican populations are not to the level the cormorant populations are yet, but they're getting there. And I'm guessing that in the not too near future, that we're going to start having some conflicts with pelicans as well, like we do with cormorants and some of the gull species. But they're a wonderful bird, super identifiable, because they're a relatively big bird, primarily white. They've got that great big bill on them. And they're a ton of fun to watch fish, yeah. And they're a ton of fun to watch fly in. They kind of fly in formation sometimes, mm-hmm. and they just drop out of the sky and land right in the water and start fishing. They're a lot of fun to watch them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rocky and Neshkoro, your turn. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've always been fascinated by birds, even when I was a little kid, and then we lost a lot of them because of the insect control. But one of the birds that fascinated me was the turkey buzzard.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if they're getting non-extincting. I've seen five or six in one spot up here around the Scoro, so hopefully they're coming back pretty good.
Yeah. Jamie, Mac?
Yeah, so the turkey vultures they're not an endangered species. They're relatively common in the state, and they also do migrate. And they're not gregarious in nature, so they're typically, individuals, not in huge flocks, but you will often see multiple individuals soaring high in the sky on the thermal currents. So, yeah, I think people notice them more often. They're fairly easy to distinguish from a hawk or an osprey or another large raptor, because they do fly in kind of a V formation, and in that their wings are a little more upright than completely horizontal. And if you look at the edging or the end of their wings, you'll actually see that they splay out those primary feathers a little bit, so you can see separation in the wing. So they're fairly easy to pick out if you see them soaring. But yeah, they're doing pretty well and feed on carrion, have excellent sense of smell and so on. Fun to watch.
And I think one of the reasons they're doing so well, and I don't have data to support this, I'm not sure the data is out there, but just my sense is that population of turkey vultures is growing also in the state of Wisconsin, as it is in the eastern half of the United States. And one of the reasons I think that's happening is because we have so much roadkill.
Yeah,
and they feed on carrion, and there's a lot of dead animals alongside the road, and you'll see them pretty commonly feeding on dead animals.
Our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. Now we're taking a look at the world of wildlife here in the state with our guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. You can join us. Go to my Facebook page. Maybe you've got a nice wildlife photo. We'd love to see that. That's the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org or call at 1-800-642-1234. And we'll turn to Neil next in Washburn County. Neil, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. I got a problem with cowbirds. We have bird feeders out, and every spring, the cowbirds are one of the first birds back, followed by orioles and grosbeaks. And I'm concerned if the cowbirds are laying their eggs in, well, I read that cowbirds lay their eggs in songbirds' nests, and I'm wondering what I can do. Now, I was looking, trapping them is pretty difficult, and when I looked in the, I checked in the hunting guide from the DNR, and they said cowbirds are protected. You can't shoot cowbirds. I'm wondering why that is.
Okay, David Drake.
Well, the cowbirds they are common nest parasites. So they as we mentioned with the Kirtland's warblers, they lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, and then they leave. And so they're kind of like the deadbeat parents of the bird world, if you will. But one of the things you can do is take those feeders down if you have cowbirds coming to the feeder, because that feeder is serving as an attractant. And if you can get rid of the feed, then the cowbirds either won't come back to your yard any longer or they won't come back as often.
You take them down for what, a couple weeks?
Yeah, take them down for a couple weeks. Or, you know, cowbirds are going to eat seeds like safflower seed and sunflower seed and things like that. So if you want to just take those feeders down, but perhaps leave up your thistle feeder or your hummingbird feeder, you could do that. So you can think about that. And then I'm going to caution, I'm be cautious on the laws, because I don't recall the law on the cowbirds. Because some of the blackbird species that they are not protected, and you can depredate them, or you can kill them as damage is occurring, or the great caveat, or as you anticipate damage to occur. And I can't remember if cowbirds are included in that or not, but whatever the DNR regulations say, that I would abide by that. Or if you have other questions about regulations, contact the conservation officer in your county or the DNR biologist in your county, and they can help navigate you to the proper law and regulation governing cowbirds, so you don't get in trouble. But if they are migratory birds, and that's if they are protected, that's the reason they're protected, is because they're migratory.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Your call on migratory reminded me that there are some birds that are already getting ready to migrate. Is that right, Jamie?
That's true. Some of the shorebirds are already at least staging or starting their migration. Most of the shorebird migration will peak in early to middle of August. And what you're looking for, if you want to get out there and observe some shorebirds, are some mudflats. So many of the state properties, wetland habitat, they'll actually do either a drawdown or just reduce the water levels so that shoreline is now exposed, and some aquatic vegetation or emergent vegetation will begin growing, and there'll be seeds and food that supply the shorebirds. That habitat is very intermixed throughout the state, so it's not there's not a lot of it, so that stopover habitat, as we call it, is really critical to migrating birds. And as far as being able to see some of these shorebird species, if you go to Wisconsin eBird, which we talk about a lot, those are reports by professionals and avid birders that report their sightings at the various viewing areas across the state. And I was just visiting it this morning, but lots of places like Horicon and Goose Pond and Nine Springs, Eway, those are just excellent places to get a glimpse of some of the shorebirds. And they can be a particularly difficult group of birds to identify.
Yes, they can.
It's probably a good time to mention that there are a number of apps for smartphones out there, in addition to the printed field guides, but these apps are pretty fun to play with too. I've been playing with one called iBird Pro that allows you to toggle different features of the bird. So the state that you're in, the habitat that you found it in, the relative size, the length of the bill, the length of the feet, coloring. And the more you toggle and are able to distinguish, the fewer potential results end up in the search. And then you can go by looking at some of the pictures. So.
And if you are going to go look for shorebirds, it helps to have a very, very good pair of binoculars and especially a spotting scope.
Yeah, that's...
So a spotting scope on a tripod, if you have one of those or access one of those, bring that along, and it will help tremendously.
We have next Jen and Madison, John and Madison, excuse me, with a question. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Very interesting program. I was having a timber stand improvement thing done in Richland Center, and they were looking for bats. And then it came to mind that I've had my share of bats in my house here, and I also know that with all the weatherization processes going on, that bats are losing their habitat. The other thing is my friend from up north said that his outdoor bat house is just loaded with guano because there's so many mosquitoes. Now, my question is how are we doing with weatherization losing bat habitat in houses because you're sealing them up and the bats aren't able to get in or get out? And what would be the use of bat houses or bat houses as a project for something like some of the rural FFA people who are always looking for interesting projects?
Hey, John, great question and an excellent suggestion. If you're familiar with the wood duck challenge that the Wisconsin Outdoor News newspaper does, they every year will put out a full-page article and challenge people to build wood duck houses. And then in subsequent issues of that newspaper, there's pictures of young children and their grandparents or their parents with a completed wood duck house or maybe half a dozen of them. So I think a challenge going out there is great as far as bats go. And bats face a lot of uncertainty right now that we have white-nose syndrome detected in the southwestern part of the state. And in much of the eastern part of the country. But as far as bat houses go, the thing to keep in mind is that there are very specialized designs for bat houses, as there are for wood ducks and squirrels and kestrels and all the other species. But very specific designs, probably one of the best places or sources of information would be Bat Conservation International. And they talk about the proper dimensions of a bat house, a variety of different styles and capacities of houses, and also placement. And just a lot of really helpful information. And their website is batcon.org. Again, just a really, really great place. You can also purchase bat houses even in the Madison area, but I would suggest that you look for houses that are BCI or Bat Conservation International certified. Mm-hmm. So they've kind of been stamped with the approval. And then there's tips as far as where to place them. On a pole in the middle of an open area, because bats are insect eaters. And they're flying around and need to be mobile, so not in the middle of a woods, but on a pole high up as you can get it. And they really don't need to be cleaned out from year to year like wood duck houses do. They have an open bottom, and the guano drops to the ground, and you can clean that up if you'd like, but there's no maintenance within the box that needs to be done. Another place would be on a south or east-facing side of a building that's going to retain more heat for the bats, especially in our state.
Mm-hmm. I think, didn't Scott Craven put together, along with some other folks, an extension publication that had bat houses in it as well? It was, I forget, it was it's Shelves, Birds,
shelves, feeders, houses, and, yeah. Go ahead.
I think it's Feeders, Shelves, and Houses or something like that. And you can find it, if you go to the University of Wisconsin Extension Publication Store, you can find it there. Yep,
yeah.
That's right.
Yep, and there's a bat house design in there as well.
Yeah, I was pretty sure of that. I actually kind of like that because there are several different kinds of bird house designs. That it's kind of fun.
And I was looking at your Facebook page, Larry, this morning before we came on, and I think there's a 3.5-minute video of a DNR bat ecologist and a volunteer who are demonstrating how to make a bat house. So if they want to go to your Facebook page, there's a nice video demonstration there.
Thank you for reminding me. Yeah. I should have remembered that myself. My goodness. So again, you don't have to be a member of Facebook if you're not a Facebook person. You can still go to my Facebook page. The name of my page is The Larry Mueller Show. So if you type all those in, All those words and you'll get it.
It's like the Ohio State University.
I knew that was coming.
Jane in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Jane.
Thank you. Over the 4th of July weekend, I was at my cottage on Pelican Lake, Wisconsin, which does not have any pelicans.
Dang, gummit.
And I don't remember ever seeing any there. But I was watching some red-headed woodpeckers that had nested in a large dead tree. I did a little bit of research, and the brood looked really large. And they said that sometimes red-headed woodpeckers would have two broods over the course of a summer. So I was wondering first whether or not I was watching the first brood, or maybe whether they would have a second batch later on in the summer, and if I should watch for that. And secondly, I used to see a lot of pileated woodpeckers and flickers, but I have not seen those in a number of years, and I was wondering if you had any reason why they don't seem to be around anymore. Thanks a lot, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Jane, thank you very much for your question. So with red-headed woodpeckers, that's a species that's also starting to be recovered here in Wisconsin and is coming back a little bit. They used to be really common years and years and years ago when we had a lot of especially oak savanna prairie. And one of the places that they're seeing a lot of red-headed woodpeckers are golf courses, because they kind of assimilate an oak savanna where they've got this wide-open grassy area, and then you've got trees scattered throughout. And so they're beautiful birds, absolutely gorgeous birds. And as with a lot of bird species, they can re-nest. So they may have one brood and then re-nest a second time, or even sometimes a third time if they're not having successful nesting the first or second time. So it is unlikely that they're combining broods, because it is too much work for one thing. And they also, the first brood would be so much older than the second brood, and that first brood would have fledged already by the time the second brood is laid. So it's most likely just it's probably one brood that you're looking at, and maybe she just had a really successful breeding year. And it's in terms of the pileated, or some people call it pileated, depending on how you want to pronounce that, it's tomato type thing. There are quite a few pileateds around. Obviously, they're the largest woodpecker species we have in the state of Wisconsin. But they stand about a foot tall or so. And, you know, a lot of these species will move around, and as will the flickers are also very common. And those two species, the pileated and the flicker, are doing quite well in terms of population status. And, you know, because they are free-ranging wildlife, it could be a couple of reasons why you're not seeing as many. They may have moved on to another area where there's better habitat in terms of food resources or dead trees, things like that. Or sometimes we just may not be as observant as we think we are, and they may be out and about when we're not, or vice versa. So there could be a number of different explanations for that. But pileated and flicker are both doing very well population-wise, and the red-headed woodpeckers are coming back, which is a nice thing.
Absolutely. We have a couple of photos on my Facebook page from Zach, who, he's got loons, they're loons.
Yeah.
He's got a photo of two loons copulating, actually. And then he's got a nest.
Oh, there's the black flies.
Yeah, yep. And then the black flies that are on the loons.
It's just insane. And we talked about this, I guess, when we were on in June.
Maybe. Yep.
That the loon production is down this year because the black flies are driving them off the nest up north. And that second picture that you see with the black flies over the head of that loon, you can see the loon's head is actually down trying to avoid the black flies in the eye and the mucous membrane. That would drive me off the nest.
Yeah.
Oh,
70 to 80% of the loons in the north were abandoned or driven off.
Yeah, it's really too bad. But some interesting photos for sure. And thank you, Zach, for sending them along. We have Tony in Madison next. Tony, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Just a quick question about bats, as to what are the dates that you're supposed to leave bats alone in southern Wisconsin?
Hey, Tony. Great question, and fairly straightforward answer. Legally, June 1st through August 15th, you cannot exclude bats from your home, and that's relatively new. And again, ties back to the threat and then eventual detection of white nose syndrome. So our cave bat species are now protected in the state with threatened status. Even though currently their populations are doing well, it's the threat of white nose and how that can disseminate bats within caves that we're being very protective of the bats and when they can be excluded. But even prior to the threat of white nose, you wouldn't want to exclude bats during that time. And that's because they have their young, and their young are flightless at the time or during that time. And if you excluded the adult bats, you would essentially cause the young pups to starve and to die in the home. So it just wasn't good practice to begin with. But yes, that time frame is June 1st to August 15th. After that, the young should be flying around, and you can take the steps to exclude them. And the Department of Natural Resources has an excellent series of publications on how to do that, and also does Bat Conservation International. So there's some excellent resources on how to go about excluding bats.
And I'm going to put a plug in for our, we've got a website as well called wildlifedamage.uwex.edu. And if you go there, we've got an extension publication on bats, and it identifies the bat species in the state and talks about their ecology, and then talks about different ways to abate conflicts with bats and buildings and things like that.
Very excellent. Thanks, Tony, a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Roxanne shot us an email. We were talking about Kirtland's warblers being present only in Adams County, but Roxanne says, I saw one in Marinette County. When I first saw it, I thought it was maybe a fledgling oriole, but I'm sure it was a Kirtland's. It was too yellow on the belly to be an oriole. Very pretty bird, and thrilled to see it.
Yep, and you probably saw the only Kirtland's warbler that is in Marinette County this year. And they've done a survey, and they found one Kirtland warbler up there, and it was a male. They have not found a female up there. And again, Kirtland warblers are pretty identifiable as a warbler goes, that they've got a white eye ring and kind of a blue-gray slate head and back, and then they've got yellow on the belly and chest. And so Larry's got a picture up on his Facebook page if you want to take a look at what a Kirtland's warbler looks like. But they're beautiful birds, and I'm glad you got to see it.
Here's Jim in Garden, Michigan with a question for you. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and a great show here. I was just curious. We live over on Big Bay Dinock on Lake Michigan, and historically we've had a lot of nesting bald eagles there. And over 2 years ago, an energy company came in and put in a large wind farm, wind turbine farm. And since they put that in, the eagles seem to be gone. There's still ospreys around and vultures and so forth, but it seems like the eagles have moved out. I was just curious, what effect, if any, these turbines are having? Is it noise? Is it, what is it, if anything?
Okay.
Yeah, Jim, that's a really good question, and it's a very current issue right now. So I had done a bunch of research looking at bird and bat impacts from wind energy, and had a postdoctoral student working with me, and we published a paper that looked at the post-construction use of the airspace by raptors. And we found for the 2 years post-construction compared to 1 year pre-construction that we had a significant decrease in terms of the number of raptors using the airspace, and also in terms of the raptor diversity. But so it is possible that those birds are avoiding the area. One of the things we're trying to do now is we're going to start a research project up this next spring. We want to go back in years 6 and 7 post-construction, see if those raptors have adapted and are coming back to that area. We don't know that yet. But in terms of bald eagles, I believe it was out in Oregon that a wind farm just got what's called a take permit by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and so they're allowed to kill up to, I think, 2 or 5 bald eagles a year. Not that they're necessarily going to, but in case a bald eagle is killed by a wind turbine out, I think it's in Oregon, that they're legally covered, and they're permitted to take up to, I think, 5 bald eagles a year. But typically, bald eagles are not affected, and I'm not aware of any literature that suggests that a bald eagle has ever been killed by a wind turbine up to this point.
Very interesting.
But there are some issues possibly with disruption and pushing them out of that airspace and things like that, and hopefully they'll come back, Jim, and you'll be able to see them in future years.
Yeah,
we definitely hope so, and from what we understand, the energy company is planning on getting more aggressive with more sites in the area. So it's something that definitely needs to be understood before they start building more turbines in the Great Lakes.
So typically bats are affected much, much more than birds are, regardless of what the bird species is. And so that's that's the major concern is the impact of bat species. Mm-hmm. But good question.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Art in Lake Dubé a chance. Art, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I'm hoping you can help me identify an eagle that we've got roosting, not roosting, but seems to make our front yard posting point for looking around. It's a dark brown. We thought it was an immature bald eagle because we have a lot of bald eagles up there, but it's about half again as big, if not even bigger, than a mature bald eagle. We've had them use the same tree, and we've been able to compare them side by side.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the question. Perhaps you'd be able to catch a picture of it at some point, which you'd be more than welcome to email into the show, and we can help you confirm that. But in our state, there are two eagles, bald eagles, far more common, and we do see the golden eagle from time to time, although we are on kind of the eastern edge of their range. They're more of a western species, but they have been seen in the state. And
we had a pair of them up on the tree this morning.
Okay. So the tricky part with the eagle identification is that for the bald eagles, it's really easy to tell what they are when they have that nice white head that we're all familiar with. But the eagles don't get that white head until they're 4 years old. It takes 4 years. So they're in that immature plumage for the first 4 years of their life. And if you do maybe do some looking online, if you just type in the two species, you can get some better photos or refer to a field guide. But the online resources are just so numerous right now. But the underside of the bald eagle, if you do see it in flight, and I'm assuming we're dealing with immature birds here, they're going to have white armpits, and that white extends underneath the wing as you're looking below from below. And the golden eagle, the immature, is going to have white, but it's going to be out towards the secondaries or out further on the wing, not in the armpits, and it's going to be more of a patch than a long line of white coloring. So that might help you if the bird takes wing or takes flight, and you can take a look from the underside. But otherwise, you know, again, looking online a little bit at some of those photos should be
helpful.
Well,
would a juvenile be that much bigger than an adult?
No, and really there's not, I don't think there's a noticeable size discrepancy between the golden and the bald. The golden's probably slightly larger, but I don't know that you would pick up on that. And the adult's going to be the same size or larger than the immature.
The only difference is that so in raptors, they have what's called reverse sexual dimorphism. So the females are typically larger than the males. So you might be looking at a female.
A pair.
If you're looking at the pair and one's larger than the others, the larger one's the female. But the other bird I'd throw out there, and it's not as large as an eagle, but, you know, size can be deceptive and it's all relative. But you might also want to look up osprey.
And see. We're about 30 feet away. So
you're close.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, take a look at osprey as well as the golden and bald eagle when you look things up online or in a bird book and see if it would be one of those three species. Most likely it's a bald eagle versus a golden eagle.
Right.
Yep. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. And we have Laura in New Berlin with a question next. And Laura, we'll get to you in just a second. Just a reminder, we're talking about the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Knack of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack. You can join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. If you want to post a photo, the best place to post it is on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post there. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We had on my Facebook page, Carly sent us a photo. Carly's from Cedarburg area. My dad wants to know what kind of frog this is and if it's local to our area. We live about 30 minutes north of Milwaukee. Pretty little froggy.
It's a great picture.
Yeah.
So that is a gray tree frog, and they've got little suction cups on their toes, so that allows them to climb. And my guess is that frog is hanging out because they have some outdoor lights or lighting, and that is attracting insects. And they'll come to those windows and walls at night and feed on the insects. So I've got young daughters myself, and they are very interested in looking for frogs at night, although it stays light pretty long right now. Yeah. It's hard to keep them up that long, but We've been coming across a tree frog even during the day, doing some yard work, coming across them along the siding and in the vegetation as they're seeking cooler temperatures during the day. But it's fun to find them.
Oh, and you can see on that picture that you can see the suction cup toes. Yep.
That's why it's a good picture.
It's a great picture, yep.
And, so go to my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, if you want to see that frog photos from Carly. And Laura in New Berlin's been patiently waiting, so let's go to her. Hi, Laura. Thank you for waiting.
Hi, Larry. Thanks, everyone, for the excellent discussion. I was glad to hear David Drake mention the roadkill because it's almost never mentioned, and I wonder if anyone has thoughts why that is. It would seem it should be a standard mention in the effort to curb this ongoing human encroachment into every nook and cranny of the planet. In fact, I remember hearing on public radio more than a decade ago, some researchers estimated that nationwide there could be 1 million casualties per day. And it sure seems to me like this is an ecological catastrophe, and I wonder why it's not even mentioned. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Laura, I'm not sure what how to respond to your comment. It's a very good comment, and I think it's just an issue that we have road structure throughout this country. And we've got wildlife, especially, in suburban type areas where you've got a high density of roads and a high density of vehicles. We also have a high density of certain species of wildlife, and they're crossing the roads to get from one side to the other. And we're trying to get places, and it's just a bad mix of roads, cars, and wildlife. And I think we're beyond putting the genie back in the bottle on this, unfortunately.
Yeah. Although I'll offer a few positive comments to that. There's been a lot of work on locating crossing points. So for turtle crossings, I can think of a few that I've come across where mitigation has been done to either have a crossing that funnels wildlife below ground or underground. Some states and countries are ahead of us on that. But these roadkill crossings, or even just alerting people with a sign of a turtle and a caution sign to slow down during that time of the year. David, your family every year is involved with helping tiger salamanders across the road over near Middleton by Shoveler Sink as they emerge. So there are certainly efforts out there, and there is a new effort by the Department of Natural Resources to report turtle sightings on the road, mortality, in order to figure out where the hot spots are for turtle mortality, in hopes of being able to offer some mitigation in those hot spots. And I was on that website not that long ago, and reports are already coming in, and they're plotting that data on a state map, and you can start to see kind of hot spots for those reports, and that might be something just kind of fun to track.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a great, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 months ago, there's this great thing that came out where these radio hosts were having a call-in show, and this woman called in, and in all seriousness, she said, why do they locate the deer crossing signs where there's so much traffic? Why don't they put those signs where there's no traffic and the deer will cross at those points instead of these very, very busy intersections and things like that? If you Google it, it's quite a funny exchange.
Oh, my goodness. I heard that. Yeah. I heard it online.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Well, moving right along, Roy and Toma has something. Hi, Roy.
Hi there. I have a question regarding wildfires, forest fires, and a possible solution. I just don't understand how a million acres of woodlot can be completely destroyed. Did that lightning strike catch them by surprise? If you take a box of kitchen matches and wrap a rubber band around them, light one, all of them will burn. But if you take that same quantity of kitchen matches, representing trees in this case, and you separate them, you light one on fire, not all of them are going to get destroyed if you separate them. Why can't we have a swath, just a clear cut, every so often so that you might lose 1,000 acres instead of 1,000,000 acres in one lightning strike?
Mm-hmm. Well, Roy, some of that, that strategy makes sense theoretically, but applying that on the ground or across the state of Wisconsin, you come into some issues just dealing with both public and private land, and public land isn't you know, there's a lot more private land and landowners across the state. So just applying that on the ground would potentially be difficult. But there is a lot of information that the Department of Natural Resource puts out through the Bureau of Forestry in terms of how to prevent wildfires, how to protect your homes. Some of it is, you know, when you do a timber harvest, cleaning up the slash so that you don't leave fuel on the ground. But also, some of these occurrences have, I mean, before European settlement, were a big part of regenerating habitat. And we talked about the Kirtland's warbler and jack pine is regenerated through fire. And it's the heat of the fire that sets the seed and allows it to become fertile and grow new jack pine. So it's a balance, but in terms of preventing some of these large catastrophes, that's something that's constantly being evaluated and trying to mitigate that potential loss. So mm-hmm. I think just the idea is a very good one. It makes a lot of sense, and that's a strategy they use, but applying it on the ground might be hard when it comes to both public and private land.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thank you, Roy. Steele in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes. The couple of comments on bats got me thinking. I've had some bats living. I have a patio and there's a deck above, and they for a couple summers would get between the wall and the joist and hang out for the summer. And then the spring there was one. But last fall I was looking to the south, maybe about 500-600 yards away. It was a clear day, getting twilight, and I saw a flock of something, and I was saying, Jesus, those are awful small. And I looked, and the bat flew out from under the joist and headed toward that crowd. So when you have, and it was getting toward fall, getting chillier, and I was wondering when it was going to leave, how do bats that solitarily sleep around, do they get together at one point, and could he have heard them that far away, and what do they do in the winter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Steele, that's a very good question. So typically July 15th is roughly the general start of migration south for bats, and so they've already started, and they'll peak usually end of August, beginning of September. Is kind of the peak, and then they'll kind of trickle into maybe October, something like that, middle of October, is roughly the time frame for southward migration in the fall. And there's a number of factors that kind of drive the migration, but the biggest one is the amount of daylight that's available. And as that daylight either increases or decreases, that is kind of the general driver about what tells birds or bats it's time to migrate, or if you're going to hibernate, it's time to start getting ready to hibernate, or whatever the case might be. And so it could be a number of things that drove that migration, and for example, drove that bat to see the flock. It could have been just pure coincidence. Certainly bats are echolocating to some extent, not a lot while they're migrating because it uses up a lot of energy, but they also will start emitting calls. You know, there could be some other cues that we may not be aware of that the bats are picking up, that, hey, you know, we've got a flock going by. And also could have been that bat that is coming out of your house just so happened, because twilight was starting to set, that it all of a sudden starting to wake up and it's going out to feed, and it may have come back to your house later that night because it might be roosting and even hibernating in your house for the winter. So yeah. There's a bunch of possibilities there, but it's a pretty neat thing to see. If you see a flock of bats flying, it's it is a pretty impressive sight.
Absolutely. Thank you, Steele. Appreciate the call. Julius in Michigan, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Question about oriole feeders. If you lay a garden hose, or leave a garden hose lay on the lawn for an hour in weather like this or like yesterday, the first water out is awfully hot. I hang my oriole feeders in as much shade as I can, but particularly the glass ones. Does that get too hot for them to drink? I'd hate to see an oriole. I have a lot of orioles, but I'd hate to see them burn their tongue or whatever.
You know, interesting question. Jamie Nack?
It is. I guess I didn't really think about that much. I was thinking I just replaced my hummingbird feeders about every 2 to 3 days right now because it's so hot, you don't want to have that mold growing. So even if it hasn't been completely depleted, you need to replace it frequently. And I was thinking when I take it off the stove or out of the microwave with the sugar solution, I usually let it cool for a few hours because I'm worried about it being too hot for them. So I never thought of it the other way around. But I do hang our feeder in the shade. I think that's a really great suggestion. I would imagine that the birds figure that out, probably feed early in the morning or in the evening when it's much cooler temperatures, and avoid it during the peak of the day if it is, in fact, on the warm side. I think the strategy that you suggest in putting them in the shade is a sound one.
I don't know what happened to me this year. I always have had Baltimore Orioles, and this year I hear them in our mm-hmm. in our neighborhood, but I don't think I've had a single one on my Oriole field.
Yeah. You know, we've had a pretty good year, though, in terms of weather and rain and productivity in terms of fruit and things like that, natural food sources. And I'm not sure that they were driven to the human-provided food as much as in past
years.
We
had them early. We had them early, but not so much of late.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Still hear them, though. Still hear them out there. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today. David, wildlife specialist with Extension and an associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie Knack, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW. They are going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we will be back. Stay with us! We are so fortunate here in Wisconsin to have an amazing amount of wildlife. Many, 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 many different species, and they're really a treasure for our state. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Jamie Knack, one of my guests today, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie, great to have you with us.
It's wonderful to be here.
And David Drake. David, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, and he is also of the Department of Wildlife, Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And David, great to see you again, too.
Thank you, Larry.
We have many callers who are interested and have wildlife questions for you. We've got some emails. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo and or question on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And I hope you have a chance to go to the Facebook page because there are a lot of really kind of cool wildlife photos that we've already had posted from today's show, including a Kirtland Warbler photo. Really nice one. That one's from David. Frank in Onalaska has a question for you both. Let's go there. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And you're certainly right, Larry. We have a lot of wildlife, and I think I'm seeing most of them on the side of the road. Who's responsible for picking up the dead carrion that you mentioned about a half an hour ago? I understood that in the past either the counties did or the state reimbursed counties. Who's picking these up or who's not picking these up?
Frank, I think it's a great question. I don't have a solid answer for you other than it does vary by county and the decisions. I believe in some counties they just don't pick up roadkill. Some counties it may be deer only. There's a new law passed by the Department of Natural, well, I guess it'd be state legislature, but that allows for, if I remember this correctly, that somebody who holds a license for the animal that is on the road can pick up roadkill as a means to utilize that resource further. So if it's a case of a raccoon and it meets the definition of the new law and you hold a license, a fur bearer license, a trapping license, or a hunting license, you'd be able to pick up that roadkill and utilize it. So receive, you know, take the pelt off of it and so on. So there are some steps to help clean up roadkill that have been newly passed. But as far as who's responsible, it varies by county, perhaps even municipality. And sometimes that's a bid process where a private contractor can then bid for that and they receive either a payment per animal removed. And in many cases, I believe it's probably deer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely sure on.
One thing I'm sure of, I would not want that job on these hot days when those carcasses have been sitting out under the sun.
No, that's for sure.
That's why I think we need to push, the state to pick up that responsibility when tourism and wildlife and hunting and fishing are so important in this state. We need to make that an important issue, and we need to put that right in front of the governor.
Well, keep in mind that you know the carcasses that are sitting there, as unsightly as they might be, and especially if you get near them, the stench of those carcasses can be pretty strong at times. That it is an important part of the ecosystem because there are a lot of animals that will come and eat on those carcasses and are scavenging animals and things like that. It can the negative of that is because a lot of those carcasses are road killed and they're close to the highway or close to where cars are going, that the scavenging animals can also get hit and killed as they're trying to find that food. So it can be a good and a bad thing, but there are some good things about all that the carcasses being on the landscape.
Yeah,
a lot of other
eagles
animals eat them.
Especially in the winter, they'll move towards carcasses rather than, you know, there's no open water for fishing and things like that, but they're often seen on deer carcasses in the north in the winter times.
I'm telling you, you really don't realize the amount of roadkill until I did the Grabar, which is a 500-mile bike ride across Wisconsin. It follows the Wisconsin River, essentially. And so you're on a bike for 100 miles a day or whatever. The amount of not only birds and animals, but insects.
Yeah.
Oh, my
it's
goodness
incredible.
Me. It's just absolutely incredible.
It is.
Oh, and you really know, obviously, on a bike, you're going to you notice that a whole lot.
Yeah,
for sure.
A lot more. Frank, thank you. Yeah, appreciate the call. Cornelia in Marshfield. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a Merlin in my backyard. It's a male and female and a family, and I've been told that that is highly unusual. Is this because I'm in central Wisconsin and they usually breed further north? Is that right?
Yeah, Cornelia, I'm going to also tell you that is highly unusual. It is. Are you sure it's not a kestrel?
Well, we really researched it, and I actually happen to have a bird expert from Iowa who spent the weekend here. She played. She had all her equipment. She played the sound. The bird actually talked back. I mean, do a kestrel and a Merlin sound the same? We first thought it was a kestrel, but then she has these incredible binos and does the research and goes on to this Cornell University website.
Yep.
And
yes. So the two of them don't sound terribly alike, but they certainly don't look alike. A Merlin is a much darker version of a kestrel, and they're all in the falcon family, and all those falcons typically will have sideburns. But with the Merlin, you don't really see the sideburns that well, like you would with a kestrel.
We really did a lot of research.
Okay. Yep.
But I just and she said I should report this to somebody. I'm not really a birder, but
did you get a photo?
I do, but I have a photo. It's not very good, but I'll see if I can get another one.
Yeah.
So I think if they really are Merlins, that is fabulous, and enjoy the heck out of it because it is a rather rare event that they definitely will come through our state during migration, but they don't spend a lot of time in our state, and they certainly are not common breeders in our state. But so if it is for sure a Merlin, there's a couple of things you can do to report it. One would be to go to Wisconsin eBird.
And if you
just just Google Wisconsin eBird.
Okay.
The other one is if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and you can find along their menu a button that says Contact Us. And under Contact Us, if you would type in the name Ryan Brady, R-Y-A-N, and then B-R-A-D-Y, and perhaps report it to Ryan, and he is with, I guess it's Bureau of Endangered Resources, I think that's still what they're called. But kind of the bird avian biologist for the DNR, and he would be very interested in that report.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to find Ryan Brady, I first go to the DNR.
Right. Yeah, and I bet you if you just Google Ryan Brady in Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, it will come up.
And can you just give any idea why you think it stayed here?
You know what? If because they do fly further north, and if they're kind of an open habitat bird like a kestrel is, and up in Marshfield you've got a lot of wonderful open habitat up there, and they probably found good habitat and good nesting area and suitable food, and said the heck with flying another 1,000 miles north, I'm going to nest here.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Ann in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. First off, I'll apologize for whatever background noise you hear. Secondly,
okay.
I wanted to give a report on loon population.
Okay.
I know that there has been concern about the black flies, and I vacation on a lake that is rather lengthwise. We typically have two pair, and they did have problems with their first clutch with the black flies. We have people on the lake that follow them and keep track of them, and took away the first eggs, and each pair had a second clutch, and my understanding is that each pair had one chick out of the clutch that is still surviving.
So a loon will have
they usually will have two eggs.
Yep, right?
Two eggs. So, I mean, that's a kind of a local report, and mm-hmm. they will, even when they do abandon, they mm-hmm. they will potentially re-nest, I mm-hmm. believe, if it's yep. early enough in the season. So perhaps it's... during some of those re-nesting, they've received a little bit of relief from the black flies, and we can only hope. But, you know, the data that's being reported or was reported earlier, I guess in June when we were on, was 70 to 80% were abandoning.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Right. And how that affects the overall loon population for the year is not yet determined, because there's the potential to re-nest and still fledge young. So we won't know the impact of that for a bit here.
Ann, thank you for calling. I want to give Jim and Glendale a chance to join in. Jim, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was observing some turkeys. Appeared to be a hen turkey and her chicks, or turkettes, whatever they're called.
Yeah.
Poults. P-O-L-T-S.
P-O-U-L.
Say again?
Poults. Yeah, P-O-U-L-T-S. Poults.
That's what they're called.
Okay. Anyways, they were able to fly, and I was shocked that a bird apparently so young was able to fly at all. What age are turkeys usually able to fly?
Jim, that's a good question. I'm gonna kind of think aloud here as I work through this answer. So, turkeys are obviously they're a large bird. They prefer to walk or run before they fly, but they will fly up to the roost at nighttime and then fly down in the morning. And if I recall correctly, I think the average nesting period or the incubation period for eggs is on turkeys is roughly 28 days. So let's just say a month, and then they hatch out and. They're what's called precocial, so that as soon as they hatch out, they're able to move that day off the nest, because the turkeys are ground nesters and they want to get them away from that nest, which has the smell of those eggs and the nesting material there, which could attract predators. So they move away from the nest relatively quickly after hatching out, and I'm guessing probably another month and they'll get their flight feathers. So I would guess probably a month after they leave the nest that mm-hmm. they're able to fly, something like along those lines.
And they, yeah. you know, they don't migrate at all. So they're
right.
You know, when they do fly, it's either to get into the roost tree or it's to fly away quickly from a perceived predator. But they're not capable of a long, sustained flight.
Yep, that's right.
Well, I'm certainly glad they're able to, because they had to respond to my dog, which let out
yep.
after them.
Yeah.
There you go. You know, we were talking earlier about, and I forget what species we were talking that had been benefited from. Oh, Kirtland Warbler were benefiting from golf courses.
Oh, the redheaded woodpeckers.
Redheaded woodpeckers. Yeah. But I'll tell you, another species that's doing really well on the golf courses is the turkey.
Turkeys, yep.
Turkeys.
Yep.
I was out golfing the other, a week or two ago, and five big old gobblers walked right across in front of me and paid no attention to me at all. I'm probably 30 feet from them.
We could probably do a whole show just on turkeys
and
how they've adapted to, you know, human development and increase their population. And that's a really interesting story.
Yeah, even their northern distribution in the state, nobody ever thought they'd be that far north. And they're in every county of the state.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing. Jim, thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. Tom in Manitowoc. Hi.
Yes, I had read a article in a magazine a while ago, you were talking about the turtles walking across the road, and they actually took a rubber turtle and they put it in the road to see how vehicles would react. And a lot of the vehicles would actually drive way into the other lane just to hit that turtle. Why can't the DNR wardens use a rubber turtle to catch the people doing that? And if the word was out there that you would get a citation, maybe people would stop going after those turtles.
Yeah, Tom, I remember reading that same study and that research finding, and it's really disheartening, especially as something as simple as a turtle and non-threatening as a turtle.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of senseless things happening. We see other acts of brutality on wildlife, usually from the younger population, thrill killings, they've been kind of termed. And as far as the conservation wardens, if a conservation warden saw that behavior, I would like to think they would certainly make contact with that individual. And they would also be there were certain laws that would be broken there, just like in the cases of the thrill killings. Unfortunately, there's not as many wardens as we'd like to think on the landscape. So maybe not even one per county in some cases. So, certainly if they see that behavior or you can report that behavior and get a license plate, it might be something they can deal with and will deal with. But they're tasked with enforcing fish and wildlife laws, but also environmental regulations and snowmobiles and ATVs and boating, and have a lot under their jurisdiction. Good point.
Brenda on Facebook says we have an owl nearby that comes around. There are always little birds following it and tweeting it. Mm-hmm. Also saw this another time while we were driving. Is this to warn other little birds the owl is near?
Yep. So owls are a predatory bird, and a lot of times you'll see this with other raptors like hawks and things like that, that birds will get together in flocks and kind of mob that owl or the hawk. And this is real common with crows, where crows will get together and kind of start calling and mobbing a hawk or owl. And it is a behavior when you're flocking together, there's safety in numbers, but it also warns other birds in the area that there's a predatory bird nearby and just pay attention.
Joan in Cedarburg, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. This last March, I was looking out my window, and I'm near the Cedarburg bog, and I saw a predatory bird attempting to hunt a small flock of turkeys beneath a conifer, and I was curious what type of bird could that be.
You know, it could be any number of things, Joan, but possibly a red-tailed hawk. It possibly could be eagle.
Yeah.
Yep, something like that. You know, and depending on the size of the turkey, if it was the young poults, there's a lot more raptors. It opens up the possibility for the type of raptor it could be. If it's an adult turkey, that limits the number of possibilities of raptors, because those adult turkeys are pretty big, and it would have to be something big like an eagle.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, it was definitely adult turkeys. There were no chicks yet at that time.
Okay, yep. Yeah, it's probably an eagle.
Yeah, probably an eagle. And thank you very much for calling. Before I forget, I want to, a state fair's coming up pretty soon, and I know that the DNR has really revised its exhibit.
Yeah, they have a different theme just about every year that they put a lot of effort into and a lot of thought. That process has already started for 2015's theme. But this year they're going to highlight the Wisconsin Wild Turkey, Pheasant, and Waterfall Stamp Design Contest. So those artists had to submit their entries on Monday of this week. They'll get they'll have a team that will decide on the winners of each of those categories. And those first through third place for each of the stamps will be on display in the DNR's conservation area of State Fair. And State Fair runs from July 31st to August 10th. So they'll be on display for that entire time in the conservation area of the DNR's exhibit. So you'll get to see some of that artwork.
It's on one end of the facility.
Yeah, it's
nice place.
Yeah,
it
should
sure
be in
is.
The covered pavilion area.
Yeah. And that reminds me, too, that the University of Wisconsin has its day at the State Fair,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, if you want to pick a day to go and see both of those, both the artist work and the contest winners, but also go on UW Day. It's going to be Wednesday, August 6th, and it is a whole heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, they've got Bucky Badger there.
Yeah, if you like the Badgers and support the team. But they'll have the band will march. There's a little parade. There's also exploration stations, which we've been involved with in the past, but unfortunately can't attend this year. So there'll be exploration stations that the kids can get involved with. And lots of games and lots of Badger Red.
Oh, yeah.
Will you be broadcasting that day later?
Not this year. Okay. I wish I could be there. I am out of town that week.
Yeah.
So for once, I'm not going to be here when the state fair is on, which is really bad.
It is a lot of fun. Yep.
Yeah.
I used to broadcast every day from the state fair, and that was really a lot of fun. But, oh, well. John and Boaz has a question for you. Hi, John.
Hi. I was wondering, the snapping turtle, is it native to Wisconsin, and how big do they get?
Mm-hmm. They are native. They're fairly common, really hard to mistake for any of the other turtles. And they get to be, their carapace, the top of their shell, can get to be 16 inches. Maybe slightly more on some of the really old turtles, and they can live a long, long time, decades.
Yeah. Well, 16 is pretty good, but I have seen some that I swear...
Yeah. 2 feet.
Yeah, 2 feet.
Yep. And the other turtles that can get that large are the soft shell turtles that you see along the major river systems can get to that size as well. So, yeah, I'd say 2 feet is approaching their upper limits.
Yep. Yeah, we've talked a lot about roadkill and, you know, animals crossing roads. And somebody had on your Facebook had posted about the swallows and the gravel shoulders and things like that. But, you know, look for turtles nesting along the gravel shoulders of the roads, especially where wetlands are nearby. And that's a real common sight. And they'll dig a hole, deposit the eggs, and they'll leave. And then the hatchlings are left on their own to fend for themselves.
And if you want to spend a little time outdoors and have some fun, there's an outdoor skills event at Horicon Marsh.
Yeah, so Saturday, August 9th, a great family opportunity to learn some outdoor skills. There'll be some birding and cooking demonstrations. The Horicon Bowmen and the DNR are going to offer an archery camp, so you get a chance to use some of the national archery and the school's equipment to try your hand at archery. There'll be some cast iron cooking and a chance to try some of the food cooked over an open fire. The Wisconsin Trappers Association will be there with a collection of fur bearer pelts and traps and some information there. And lots of other birding. I think they're going to have some duck and goose calling and a chance for participants to try their hand at fly tying. So just a wonderful array of outdoor skills will be on hand. August 9th at Horicon.
And that food, I tell you, well, there's nothing better than
I know.
Cooked over an open fire in the outdoors.
It takes a while, but the wait is well worth it, right?
Oh, my goodness me. I tell you, we have a little fishing trip we do every year, and I think one of the big highlights is the being on an island with a fire going and whatever fish you've got.
Yep, having a traditional shore lunch.
Oh, right.
I'm going to have to stop us right now because I am so hungry already. You guys are killing me.
Well, you know, time to go and eat. And time for you to stay listening in here. Our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack, both with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and David also UW Extension. It's great to have them with us, and they'll be back hopefully soon, and we will do this all over again with them. So... hope to have them back, and just looking forward to tomorrow at 11. We'll talk astronomy, some neat things going on, Jim Lattice and Tom Hall. And then Victoria Houston, Wisconsin author, talks about her latest Loon Lake mystery book. Stay with us.